Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God. And actually, we were going to be talking about the feasts. At least that was the topic this morning. I usually save the metaphysical stuff more for this show, but actually, I covered a great deal of that in the show this morning. And so I don't know how much we will touch on that. Basically, the feasts had a geopolitical purpose for Israel. They weren't just a party. I mean, you can go to Oktoberfest in Germany or harvest festivals or Thanksgiving in America. There's always these events that are based on kind of a fall festival like the Feast of Tabernacles. But they have, generally speaking, a completely different purpose. And a lot of people in America have started doing the feasts again. A lot of church groups start doing some of them. I mean, Easter is really left over from the original Passover. We call it Easter now. All that's kind of pagan rituals that have been brought into it. And you can have, you know, you can follow what appears to be pagan rituals for good purposes or for bad purposes. And that's what we were talking about this morning, is what is the function of the festivals? What was the function of Passover? What was the function of Easter? And some people will tell you that Passover was foretelling the coming of Christ and the sacrifice of Christ and the cross and, you know, the blood of the Lamb and all these kinds of things. And to some degree, that's true, but that is not the purpose and function of the festival in society. That's the thing, is that there can be multiple reasons why you have a festival or a feast. Now, Passover was really a part of Pentecost, because you started counting the days from Passover. I mean, you have Feast of Weeks and, you know, Feast of Unleavened Bread, whatever you want to call these different, there's lots of different names for the different feasts and festivals of Israel. And they came about at a number of different times and for different reasons and to mark different things. But in actuality, the Feast of Pentecost and the Feast of Tabernacles, you know, one is in the spring and the other one is in the fall. And of course, during the summer, you're planting crops and harvesting crops and protecting crops and taking care of animals. And so these festivals in the spring and the fall had a different socio-political purpose. Now, I say socio because, you know, it's a big gathering. It's a big festival and people can have a lot of fun. Right now, they're about to have Burning Man Festival in Nevada. It's just south of us, and whenever they have that, lots of people are coming down from Seattle and Portland, and they have to pass. There's only one road going down that way, so a lot of the people come down that road, and that goes right by us, and it's what we call burners, and they are a strange lot. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of people going down there. I mean, they get 50,000 people coming there, paying at least an average of $400 or more dollars per person. Some people pay several thousand dollars and have a chef, you know, chef and special treatment and everything. And so it's a multi-million dollar event that people pay lots of money to go to. And they have it out on an alkali flat that is just, you know, when the wind comes up, I mean, you're taking your life in your hands, because alkali dust is not good for you, to say the least. And it's probably covered with smoke now because there's so many fires in Oregon and California. But anyway, they're down there. They're all headed down to Burning Man. And they'll be down there till next week, and then they'll be coming back up. Now, we have a Burning Bush Festival here in Summer Lake, and we have it every year. And usually we don't get 50,000. We'd be lucky to get 50 people. We can get more, but we can get we have had less, but it's a long ways to come. We're way out in the middle of the desert. Although we're not doing an alkali flat, we have green grass and meadows, and if we have it on the church property, which we are now securing and going to start developing more and more, there's room for 50,000 people there without the alkali flat. So, and there's water running everywhere, but we're not inviting the low-hanging fruit, as some people refer to the burners, because they're there for the party. That's why they go. It's, and, you know, they have music and they have events and probably have drugs and scantily clad women and voyeurism of all sorts, shapes, and sizes. And that's not what we're interested in. There's a different purpose for the festival. The same as, you know, the Oktoberfest in Germany, there's a lot of beer drinking. Now, we've had beer at some of our festivals. We made homemade beer, homemade wine, and shared it with the people that came. And we can do that, but we're not going to have drunkenness and alcoholism. and what we are really going to focus on is the purpose of the festival. And this festival of Israel actually brought, like I say, socio-geopolitical power to Israel. It made Israel invincible, and these festivals played a huge part in that operation. And it is amazing today in the modern churches, including the people who decide to go back and try to celebrate the festivals, almost none of them attend to the actual purposes and function of the early festivals. Now, Passover was a meal, and it was, everybody would gather in homes. They would pick a home. So there might be 4, 5, 10 families, and they would pick the people with the largest home, and they would gather in that home for the night, and they would barbecue a lamb. And when they butchered the lamb, they'd put the blood of the lamb on the doorposts, and they're sharing this lamb, and people are, it's kind of a potluck or potlatch, as some call it, Jacob's supper, as some call it. Everybody brings food to this gathering. They gather in a house, they close the doors, everybody stays fully dressed with their sandals on, ready to leave, supposedly staff in hand at a moment's notice. But they're sharing a meal of unleavened bread. Now, all these things that are described, including some of the other dishes and foods and, you know, bitter herbs and stuff like that, they are all symbolic of a particular way of interacting in a free society. And they're telling you about being ready and about being together and being committed and sharing and not and inviting as many people as possible so that you could eat the whole lamb. You don't exclude people. And it's all about local congregations gathering, resolving issues, resolving problems, overcoming resentments and angers that may have occurred during the year in a small town because you did this or that or the other thing. And becoming, you know, sharing a meal again, becoming comrades. Everybody, you know, when somebody would get mad at somebody else, I'm not going to darken their door again. In other words, I'm not even going in their house again. I'm not going down to that house again. I won't be in the same room as that person. Well, at Passover, all that has to change, and that you're willing to be in the same room as everybody and you stay there all night. So you work out your differences and you learn to get along again. But 50 days later, you've got this Passover, Pentecost. Penta meaning 50. And so what happens then? Well, in Israel, I mean, Jesus had resurrected. Jesus walked around. He ate. He drank. He said, I wasn't going to eat or drink again until I do so in the kingdom. And there he is eating and drinking with the apostles and with other people and breathing on them and delivering to them the Holy Spirit And yet, at Pentecost, they were all gathered together, not just 12 apostles, but 120 names. That's 120 identities, 120 families were in this upper room, which had to have been a pretty good sized upper room. And Jesus was supported by people of substance. Chusa and Joanna and lots of other people supported Jesus with their substance. Yet there, he's walking around in sandals and people are feeding him. And what substance does he need? Well, he was setting up another form of government that operated on faith, hope, and charity. He would sit down with the tax collectors and he would talk to the tax collectors about, hey, you know, you should be doing this through charity, because if you take care of the needy of your society through taxation, you will cause society to drift apart. You won't create the bonds of a strong society. Any sociology professor should know this. Yet sociology professors, to the tune of 90 to 100% in most colleges, are Marxists, or at least socialists, which is just a polite word of saying a Marxist. And they should know that Marxism, socialism, weakens the people. One of the things that you have is that you're liable to have a great deal of drugs and alcohol in a society that is socialist. Well, in the Teutons, amazing, where they had the original beer fest, the fall festivals, and they had them there. They made beer, barley beer. That was a big thing. They made that. But there was almost, according to historians like Tacitus, there was almost no alcoholism whatsoever amongst the Teutons. There was almost no divorce whatsoever amongst the Teutons. Everybody, all the Teutons were married. All the Teutons wanted to have children. Many of the Teutons had large families. And cheating on your wife, or somebody cheating, not cheating on your wife so much, but, you know, cheating with somebody else's wife, was often incurred a death penalty. One of the common punishments was that a bunch of guys would grab you, tie you up, and throw you into bog. And you would slowly sink down in the bog. The more you struggled to get the ropes off, the more you'd sink into the bog, and you were pretty much dead. It'd be rare that you could get out. Depending on how mad you made them, that would determine how tight the knots were. So it was pretty, you know, it was a different kind of society. I'm not going to say that nobody ever cheated on their wife and there wasn't some marital problems. There were orphans, non-existent. Everybody wanted to have children. If somebody died, somebody adopted those children. They took care of them. Go to Rome. Alcoholism was everywhere. Cessation of marriage was actually common. Divorce was rampant. And to the point where the cessation of marriage was almost ended. People just lived together and wives changed husbands. And it wasn't just in Rome. You saw the same thing amongst the Samaritans. We see that with the Samaritan lady who had had five husbands. And of course, according to Jesus, she had had none because she had never really made the commitment to family. But she was ready to repent. She was ready to turn around and change her ways. Rome, divorce, you know, it wasn't that way in Rome for the first 300-400 years, but it got that way. The nature of the people changed. It changed because they became accustomed to living at the expense of their neighbor. In other words, they were moving around 300 AD. They started moving in this direction towards a socialist state. Part of that was the influx of so many people because they were extremely successful. But by 150 AD, that's when Polybius wrote that they had become accustomed to living at the expense and providing their livelihood at the expense of others, because they were slowly moving into a socialist state. People always talk about Holland being, you know, one of the happiest places in Europe to live. That's very questionable because the suicide rate is up very high. Alcoholism is up very high. Depression is up very high. And a lot of people have moved out of Holland because of the oppressive taxes. I mean, You buy a new car, you're talking 150% or more in taxes. So if the car would normally cost you $50,000, it's going to cost you $150,000, $100,000, or $150,000 to buy that car, which is why everybody's riding bicycles, which is better for your health. But the reality is they're socialist, and it's a democratic socialist capitalist economy. So they have this mix. It has its drawbacks. Teutons, they were not a socialist society, yet they had a safety net. So the Sabbat and the priests of their society, they knew still that religion was the pious performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. So religion was about taking care of the needy of society. And everybody was striving to provide for themselves. Everybody was striving to provide for their family. But they also knew that, you know, the people who worked really hard but fell on hard times, you had to help them out. Their work ethic was unbelievable. Tacitus talked about that he couldn't believe how hard these people would work, because you knew that society should take care of its needy, but you knew you didn't want to be a burden to your society. You did not want to live at the expense of others. This is one of the things that they thought was so degrading in the Roman Empire, because by the time the Germans and the Teutons anyway and the Romans were interacting, Rome had decayed very much into this socialist state with their free bread and circuses to keep the people entertained and placated, and but also overtaxed. And they put tariffs on foreigners and tribute on foreigners, but even the people had to pay tribute. I mean, income tax is tribute. That is what income tax is. And so every nation in the world just about today has some form of tribute, which they call income tax. They have a number of different names for it. But that's evidence that if you're working for nothing and have to send the money to the government, you're not living in a free society, in a free state. It wasn't. America used to be free, and there used to be no income tax. There was excise and tariff taxes. An excise tax is a tax only on use. Property tax is an excise tax. But most property in America, there could be no taxes on that property because it was a freehold title. You have to divide the title in order to make property subject to property tax. And of course, all that's done, you can also waive your right to own property, and that's done. And we have really, the dog has returned to his vomit and the pig to his mire, and we've gone back. We don't own our land. We don't own our labor. They can tax us 10%, 20%, 30%, and we don't know any better. Well, Israel was a government that operated entirely on free will offerings and what they call the perfect law of liberty. The early church did the same thing. They wouldn't sign up for the social welfare programs of Rome, and that's one of the reasons they were persecuted. And the festivals were a key point in helping them create this network of charity that took care of the needy of their society, unspotted by those constitutional orders and systems of government that forced the contributions of the people to take care of the needy of their society. So the Teutons took care of the needy of their society, but they did it through free will offerings. They had festivals where everybody came together and they had their parties, but they also did something else. They organized themselves into the tens, hundreds, and thousands. Common knowledge. People had been doing that since before Nimrod. Nimrod organized the people in the tens, hundreds, and thousands too, but he did it from the top down. He appointed officers who ruled over, 10 other officers who ruled over 10 other officers who eventually ruled over 10 families. And that's the way you got these governments organized. But it was either top down or bottom up. When the people of Israel, which was bottom up, were organizing themselves through the church in the wilderness, the called out in the wilderness, and the tens, hundreds, and thousands of Israel, they were very successful. But then they got lazy and they wanted to have a king. They were told, if you want to have a king, you can go read it yourself in Samuel 8, or you can go read the pamphlet Common Sense by Thomas Paine, because he quotes the whole thing in Samuel 8, explaining that if you look to the government to protect you and protect your rights, that it will take and take and take and take and take. Because men of office, who seek office in such governments, are men who seek power, and they will seek more and more power. But in a free government, the people are seeking responsibility. Responsibility for themselves, responsibility for their family, and responsibility for their neighbor. Only in free will offering systems of charity, but still, they are looking and desiring and are diligent in taking back their responsibilities. And that's how you get rights. And that's how seeking the kingdom of God, that's what it's about. Taking back your responsibility to love your neighbor as yourself. You can do that in a small home church congregation, and you can start taking care of the needy in your congregation and helping one another out. You have to start weaning yourself off the need of the pharaohs and Caesars and Nimrods of the world, who are the benefactors who exercise authority one over the other, because we're not to be that way if we're going to be Christians. So you need to gather together to organize yourself, because each one of you in your person will eventually hold the power of the state. You're not going to make laws. The laws are already made. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, to hurt other people. You know, all the Ten Commandments, that pretty much covers it. But now you have to make sure that somebody doesn't lie, steal, kill your neighbor. You have to come to the aid of your neighbor. And the way to do that, again, is to sit down in those tens, hundreds, and thousands. And that, of course, is what they were doing in the early church, and that's what they were doing in Israel. And they were doing that to maintain a free society, that an entrance to a free society might be maintained. But who were these guys they had called out, these Levites, these Kohen, these priests of society? And what was their function? Was it to a bunch of mumbo-jumbo and superstitious rituals? Or was there a purpose to it? And of course, that's what I'm saying, is there was a purpose to the festivals. These two festivals in spring and fall, which is Tabernacles, which also involves the Day of Atonement, and just as Pentecost involves the Passover. And what do you do on the Day of Atonement? What kind of activities do you do on the Day of Atonement? What kind of activities do you do on Passover? So basically, what you do is you cement the relationships of the family and the congregation of family on Passover and Day of Atonement. And then on Tabernacles and Pentecost, you are shoring up the connections between each of those congregations, to the tune of 100 congregations, and in each group of 100 up to the tune of 1,000. And so you're picking, 10 families pick a minister. He gets together with 10 or 9 other ministers like himself, and he picks a minister. And eventually, everybody in the whole nation is connected to this network. I it's just astounding to me. I mean, I just, like, my chin drops. But somebody who had studied the Bible, think they know all kinds of stuff about the Bible, and they're going to go out and expose everybody in apostasy. And we use the word network all the time. He says the word network isn't in the Bible. There isn't anything in the Bible about a network. Well, actually, there is tons and tons of stuff about a network. They don't use the word network, but they use tens, hundreds, and thousands, tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. Actually, what they're talking about is companies. In Mark, they talk about it. Jesus is requiring his disciples to make the people sit down in this network where people sit in a company, which is a symposia in the Greek, which is usually about 10 people, which would be 10 heads of households. So they sit in a symposia, and the symposia are organized in ranks of 10 and 50 and 100. Oh, actually, 10 tens is 100. So in ranks of 100 and ranks of 50, it says. It's kind of worded a little funny in the Greek, but it's because there were 5,000 people there, and 51 hundreds is 5,000. And that's what they're talking about. So you got 5,000, so it's going to be tens, hundreds, and fifties, or tens, fifties, and hundreds. If it was 10,000, it would be ranks of tens, hundreds, and hundreds. Because 100 ranks of 100 is 10,000. So that's just the way the language works. That's the way the math works. And that's the way the network of the early church worked. So who's in the network? It's the heads of the family and all the members of the family. But the heads of the family represents one family. Because remember, Passover, you're consolidating families. Your kids are playing with your neighbor's kids at Passover because everybody's there in that same house. And they're all out in the backyard, or of course now at Passover, they're actually in the house once the sun sets. But they're gathering together and playing jacks or whatever, and interacting as children will do, and growing up as children will do. And the parents are learning to talk to each other, and they're learning to make peace. No arguing with Phil, you know, while you're at Passover now. Don't get in a fight, you know. But I can guarantee you that they'll talk politics and they'll talk things. But the fact is they learn to talk and get along. That's one skill that socialism starts taking away from people, which is why you see this tremendous movement. You see it in the colleges and on college campuses where you can't talk about this. You can't say these things. They trigger people. You can't do it. See, that's a clear sign that you're moving into a socialist state. Don't talk about that. Don't say anything. Because you can't have this interaction, and they're not good at it anymore. They lose the skill of being able to talk about serious things and still remain friends. To disagree and still remain friends. Still remain a community. That's a skill. That's an art. And because we've been going, you know, America's not starting to go socialist. It's been going socialist. Social Security is socialist. Public education is socialist. Welfare by the state is socialist. Now, welfare by the church is righteous because, well, it can be righteous. I mean, you can have bad ministers. And by the way, that's why you have bad ministers. That's why you have, you know, it's not just priests who are doing this pedophile stuff. And all priests don't do that. But there are priests that have been caught in this huge ring, I guess Pennsylvania or whatever it was. Well, at the same time, there was another Warren and his ministry, I don't know what rank he holds, but he's one of their counselors or whatever, youth people, was doing lewd stuff in front of children. And so you find it everywhere. And the reason you find it everywhere is because you're giving power to these people. When you pick a minister in the church established by Christ, you're not empowering them to rule over you. You're empowering them to serve you. And how are they going to serve you? By connecting you with other people that care about you as much as you care about other people. You see, this is a whole different dynamic. You go down and vote out there in the world. You're going to vote for people in Parliament. You're going to vote for people in Congress or the Senate or whatever. You're going to vote for the guy that you think is best for you. Now, there are some people who will vote for guys who they think are best for the whole country. But that voting for those guys is not cementing society together. As a matter of fact, in the recent election in the United States, electing Trump, it has divided the nation because some people are so hateful of Trump. And I think a lot of their hate of Trump is unwarranted. A lot of the accusations made at him are really unfounded. I mean, he's certainly a guy who's got problems. He doesn't have as many problems as some of the other rich people in the world. You know, being rich is a great temptation. It's very difficult. It's hard for a rich man to get into the kingdom because with his wealth comes great temptation. With great power comes great temptation, not just responsibility. And he is not always handling the temptation like Christ would. Let's put it that way. But still, the division where people are just, you know, the only thing they have in common is they all hate Trump, that is not healthy in a society. And the same people that have that, there was a lot of people that didn't like Obama, but they weren't having these triggered hissy fits about it. They didn't like him. Certainly a lot of people didn't like some of the other presidents, Bush, Clinton. And there was a lot of complaints that you could have made about Clinton. I mean, yeah, evidently Trump's a little bit of a womanizer and he's played around quite a bit. But the stories about, and they're not just stories, I mean, there's hundreds of witnesses that Bill Clinton had a serious, violent sexual assault problem. And, you know, he got away with it. The press were, they didn't go after him like they did. They've been going after Trump. So why is that? And I don't really care one way or the other. I have a king. I don't need Trump. I don't need Clinton. But they are guys who have risen to power in Rome, in what looks like Rome. I mean, he's commander in chief. That's what imperator means, commander in chief. He's the chief executive officer in Washington, D.C., and Caesar was often the chief executive officer in the city of Rome. And and also he was the appointer of judges throughout the empire. And of course, that's the power. You know, all the federal judges are appointed by the president, and Supreme Court justices are appointed by the president, although they have to be confirmed by Congress. But the reality is it's the same government, and they're doing the same thing. But Christ's government is different. Christ's government does not have tax collectors. They have ministers. They have a daily ministration. They take care of the needy of society. And you see Paul and Barnabas doing that. There were dearths. And they needed aid being brought to them. They picked ministers, they took up collections, and they sent aid. Now, the world was sending aid to the same area that the constitutional orders and systems of the Roman government were sending aid, but they would tax the people, take the money, and take it over to, and the supplies over to where they needed. Who was doing a better job? And that's why they had the festivals, because your local congregation, you know who needs help and you can help them. But what about somebody in Greece or somebody in Ephesus or somebody in Rome or somebody in Jerusalem that needs help and they need to get help from other areas where there are Christians? Well, you need that network. And one of the ways they built that network was through the festivals, like the pilgrimage festivals, like Pentecost and Feast of Tents or Booths, as they call it, Sukkot. And so that was the purpose, is to cement those societies and the people of the society together so that they could function as a free government under the power of God, according to the righteousness of God, which is to do it entirely by charity. And that's what they were up to, is to do all this by charity. And they were pretty good at it. And they learned how to do it, but then they got lazy and they wanted to have a central government that would do these things like the other nations. And of course, that was straying away from God. It was actually called a rejection of God. And that's what they did. So if you're going to have the festivals, you want to have the festivals where you are going to come back together and try to make these things happen, where you take care of one another in righteousness through charity. And so therefore you should be setting up that network to make that happen, because that's the way the early church did it, that's the way Israel did it, and that's the way we should be doing it. So first you have to have the congregation sit down in the companies, and then you have to network them together. And then you can have these feasts. So that I had somebody contacting me from back east and wanted to know where he could send money to help people who wanted to get to the festival. Well, You know, I know people want to get to the festival, but that isn't the channels of the God's government. Send everything to me and then I'll trickle it down to everybody else. It would make me, you know, I would get a lot of money that way. Make my life easier. But that isn't the way it's supposed to be done. So I can't tell you to do that. The way you do it is you give money in your local congregations. And then your local minister should know who should be sent. Maybe you guys want to send him. We talked a little bit about the metaphysical facts of coming and then going back again. But what I wanted to be aware of is that you could be, maybe he already has enough money that he can come. And he's doing well, so he doesn't need any money. So you give him money anyway. He knows 9 other ministers and 9 other congregations that might need some help. And so between them, in intimate conversations, they can figure out where the money should go, where the funds, wherever the help should go, where it's needed the most, and where it should go the most. And they can be wise in it. This is why your ministers should be the husbands of one wife and a family in good report, because they often are a little bit wiser about the use of funds. They have gone through it once. But anyway, we'll be right back to Keys of the Kingdom after this brief break. So welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. And so anyway, like I said, there are 3 basic festivals in Israel. There really is a little bit more than that, but that's the way some of the Jewish historians write them out. You know, you got Passover, Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, and Tabernacles, or Feast of Tents, or Booths. So you have these different events, which, of course, like I say, Feast of, you know, you have a tendency to think that Passover is something different than Pentecost, but they're really connected, because you have this 50 weeks to get to Pentecost, because what you're doing at Passover is that you're cementing who's our minister, what families are together, share a meal, we can consummate it in the sharing of that meal. And then now, and we talk about all the things that are important, the values and the of the government, pick the best guy for the job, and we send him off so that he, you know, he makes preparations. He's got 50 days to get ready for Pentecost. And then he goes to Pentecost, and he will meet with all the other ministers. Now, he's going to know some of the people that he's going to be heading there with. I went to an unregistered church meeting and I met somebody in Colorado and several other people. We were traveling by train and we came across several other people who were headed to the same event and we were on the train. Well, those are things that we can do. We could, if we were to expand the network and get the word out that there is a way for you to be a free people again, because you're not a free people now, you're in bondage. But you can actually start becoming free people while you're in bondage. You don't have to throw off. I mean, Israel did not throw off the chains which have bound them to another. Well, in a way they did, but they did it because what they did is they came together and they learned to do without the government of Pharaoh and his benefits, his straw. They didn't need his straw anymore to make bricks. They could make bricks without his straw. They gleaned in the field at night for what they needed. They weren't dependent upon his benefaction. And again, these are metaphors trying to tell you that's what you need to do. When you don't need their Social Security, when you don't need their welfare, when you don't need all their benefits, you will have become free. And you will receive the blessings of that freedom. But in order to do that, you have to strive. You have to be diligent. And of course, that's what it says. Be diligent to show thyself approved. It doesn't say study to show thyself approved. We translate it that way, but the word there is clearly diligent. Diligent what? Diligent in loving your neighbor. And how can you love your neighbor if you never meet with him to find out what he needs? And that's why you go to church. You don't go to church for a good feeling. You go to church to know what it is that you need to do to bring about a righteous relationship with you and your neighbor. Because it certainly is not righteous to force your neighbor to contribute to your welfare, which is the way in which, you know, I talked this morning about the spiritual benefits of following the ways of the kingdom, but there are also spiritual, you can call them benefits, going against the ways of the kingdom. There are benefits, you know, the difference between reward and punishment is if you don't like it, it's a punishment. If you do like it, it's a reward. All punishment is something you don't want, and you call it punishment. I mean, there was an old Twilight Zone, I think it's Twilight Zone or Outer Limits, where a guy who's a gangster, he dies, and then he supposedly, he's now in an afterlife, and he doesn't realize he's dead, and the guy who's there, who's kind of like a butler, convinces him that, oh, you are dead, and this is where you have been sent. And where he was in this nice apartment, and he could have anything he wanted. He went at gambling. He could have all the dames he wanted. He could have all the booze he wanted. Anything he wanted, he could have. And this went on for a couple of weeks, and then he said, I don't like this anymore. This is terrible. I'm feeling terrible. I said, well, you know, can't we do something different? Would you just say what you want? Well, I should be able to lose sometimes. Okay, how many times do you want to lose? No, not like that. I mean, there's no challenge. This is terrible. And he says, what kind of heaven are you running here? And the butler says, heaven? Who said anything about heaven? I'd rather you didn't use that word in here. And he says, so I'm in the other place? I thought that was all fire and brimstone and everything. He says, oh, well, we have that area too for the people who don't like this area. And of course, that's what it was, is that having everything you wanted was like hell. It took away all the incentive of life. And so supposedly he chose to go to the fiery place instead of that place. It was miserable. And there's an old saying, when the gods wish to punish us, they grant us our prayers. So if you can have anything you want, it may not make you as happy as you think. What you want is what will make you righteous, what will make you good, what will make you in accordance with God. And then happiness is a byproduct of that, but it isn't what you're looking for. You're not doing it so you get happy. And unfortunately, a lot of people go to look for a church or even a home church. They're looking for one that makes them feel satisfied, makes them feel happy. You want one that challenges you, makes you think, makes you ponder, makes you look at your faults. Adam and Eve, they sinned, and they hid from the pain of it. They need to go back and embrace the pain and face up to what they have done wrong. And then healing will come, and then happiness will follow. But you don't want to make happiness your goal. That is counterproductive. So the feast, that's what the feasts are really all about. And I warned this morning that those people who go and start reading the Bible and start looking at the jots and tittles and the letter of the law and says, oh, we have to do it on this day, and we have to do it when the moon is here, and we have to do it wearing this outfit, and we have to fence this off, and you can't have any dogs in the sanctuary, which is, again, these are metaphors. It's not about real dogs. It's a metaphor for, you know, something else that is going on in the spiritual realms. And you have to take a look at those metaphors in order to try to understand the real message and function. The real message, you know, again, and I said it this morning, I kind of alluded to it several times here. Religion is not your opinion about God. God does not change with your opinion, and your opinion changes. Your opinion is human, it's frail, it's weak. God's opinion of God is reality. Your opinion is your opinion. It may conform to reality, but then again, it may not conform to reality. It may be far from reality. And what happens is that you form an opinion of what you think God is, what you think religion is, what you think righteousness is, and then you worship that imagined opinion. And that's not what God is. That isn't what righteousness is. It doesn't conform to your opinion. Your opinion is supposed to conform to it. So having the festivals, yeah, they had rules about figuring out when it was, because then there was no argument about it. You could figure it out. And we could do that too. We could actually have several festivals for those people who are still stuck on the day. You know, you may end up in the snow, you may end up with cold nights, but we could do that. And we could set up where we teach classes and show you some of those metaphysical elements of the kingdom, teach you more about how healing actually takes place, show you things that you could do to improve your own health. You know, Moses had all these dietary laws, and people say that's all done away with. Well, your diets out there in America are killing you in the whole world, in many places. Your diets are causing, what you're putting in your body is destroying you. Now, I believe that the Holy Spirit can fix all that, but by fasting from some of the terrible foods that you eat, you may come face to face with your weakness. And so fasting doesn't mean not eating anything. It means fasting from the junk food that you commonly eat and eating a little bit better, exercising more, being diligent in the things that you do more, and so that blessings will come. And you can learn that, and in the process of learning that, you may come face to face with your own frailty, your own sin. That's why Adam and Eve were hiding after the sin in the garden, is because they didn't want to face the fact that they sinned. They didn't want to admit it. They realized, oh my gosh, I've sinned, I'm naked. You know, I'm without covering. And they didn't want to see it. I mean, it hurt them to see that, and so they hid from it. But God sent an angel with a fiery sword to light the way so you're willing to see it, because you have to see it, confess it, admit it, repent of it, and then God can restore you. One of those things that I talked about with Samuel 8 is that God said that if you want to have a ruler who rules over you, whether he's pastor, priest, or president, or prime minister, if that's what you think is going to make you great, guess what's going to happen? He's going to take and take and take and take and take. He's going to abuse you, and you're going to cry out. But God's not even going to hear you. So what do you do to get God to hear you? You have to repent and think differently. You have to stop thinking that your priest, your pastor, your president, your prime minister is your salvation. They are not. Maybe they're the servants of God, but they need to know how to serve. And how to serve is to do what Christ said. And one of the things that Christ said was he commanded his disciples, his student ministers, to make the people sit down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. He actually commanded them to do that. And you need to understand that that was a network. And the people were self-organizing themselves. The ordained ministers of Christ and the disciples of Christ were not going to pass out loaves and fishes until the people sat down. They had to sit down in that pattern first. They had to organize themselves in that pattern, and then we could help you. And so that is absolutely essential that you do that. But let's talk a little bit more about some of the other things that, you know, Christ listed off a number of things for his disciples. Now, everybody's not a disciple. I mean, everybody can play part of the role of disciple. And certainly when you support a good minister, you're a part of his ministry because you're supporting it. Just like, you know, the wife of Chuza and Joanna, they were supporting Christ's ministry. You could be supporting the ministry too. You should do it sitting down in the tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. So that you take care of it on a local basis, and then your minister can report back to you, that money you gave me, I ended up giving all that money to so-and-so because he's got this great project, and I think it would be really expanding the kingdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you have to, that's the geopolitical part. That's the political part. You're a government of, for, and by the people. But if we go back and read in Luke 14:26, it says, if any man come to me and hate not his father and his mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. He has to put his ministry of Christ before everything else. That is paramount. Now, he doesn't mean you can become a wife beater, a child beater, or whatever like that, or you abuse your parents. No, you still have to honor your father and your mother. But what he's talking about, you have to set this as a major priority. This cannot be just a weekend thing. This has got to be the direction you want to go in. And if people want to do that, we're getting ready to set up so we can start training you. But it will not be an easy road. You're going to have to really make a commitment, which brings us to what he says in the very next verse. And whoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. No excuses. You can't say, oh, well, yeah, I want to follow you, but, you know, I want to sleep till 10 o'clock. No, can't sleep till 10 o'clock. You got to get up. You got to start bearing your cross. You don't want to make somebody else bear your cross. You're going to have to carry your weight. And you're actually going to have to carry the weight of others. That you need to be a man of God is a man of labors. So in verse 28, he says, for which of you intending to build the tower sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it? So are you ready? Are you ready to finish it? Are you ready to get this ball rolling? Are you ready to make this big commitment? Do you love God to be his disciple? Now, you know, all those other people, they may love God too, and they should love God with their whole heart, mind, and soul. But we're talking about what to be a disciple. That's not just put God first, but you also have to pick up your cross. You have to carry your own weight. And sometimes that also means carrying the weight of other. Lest happily, after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him. So you have to be able to really make this commitment, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth with it whether he would be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000. So we're outnumbered. This is a huge task. What do we need to do? Have we given it thought? Well, we have. And what we need to do is require that the people sit down in tens, hundreds, and thousands. So we've helped numerous people out over the years with thousands and thousands of dollars in services and in benefits. But the reality is, if you're not sitting down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands after you've been with us for years, and then you have a need, guess what? You're going to have to turn around and go the other way. And the last thing is we see in Luke 14:33, which I'm not going to have time to go into, but you can go read it for yourself. And if you go onto our website, you can look it up and you can find out what I am referring to and what I'm talking about. But until then, I'm going to have to say peace on your house and may God be with you. And until next week, join the network and will be your public servants through Faith, Hope, and Charity. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.